Our panel is ready to go, and we will start with Professor Akhil Amar from Yale.
Do these mics work?
Before I begin, I'd just like to say two words of thanks. The first is to the Federalist Society for its graciousness in inviting me here. It's always a pleasure and an honor to be with you, to have the chance to see some old friends, and I hope make some new ones. And second, I'd like to thank the University of Michigan for hosting us here. It's a kind of homecoming of me for sorts, because 35 years ago, the University of Michigan took in as a couple of young residents two doctors from India, and I was born here, but I haven't been back in 20 years. So thank you. Let me begin by mapping out what, for this group at least, I take to be common ground. Pure socialism is bad. A system of private property, at least up to a point, is good. A regime in which the state controlled all resources threatens both individual liberty and true democracy. Quite literally, the citizen would have no ground of her own on which to stand, to define herself, and to resist government tyranny. Now I shall try to move from that common ground to stake out a position that, for this group, I presume will seem far less obvious. Private property is such a good thing that every citizen should have some. Indeed, a minimal entitlement to property is so important, so constitutive, and so essential for both individual and collective self-governance, that in order to provide each citizen with that minimal amount of property, the government may legitimately redistribute property from other citizens who have far more than their minimal share. But wait, there's more. The notion of minimal entitlements is not simply constitutive, it is constitutional. Not just constitutionally permissible, the government may distribute or redistribute to ensure every citizen a minimal stake in society, but constitutionally obligatory, the government must do so. The Constitution does not enact Mr. Herbert Spencer's social statics, but it does enact Mr. Thaddeus Stevens' 40 acres and a mule. Now that I've got your attention, let me explain. And for those of you who attended the Federalist Society Symposium at George Mason University last year, some of what follows is somewhat redundant, so I apologize in advance and hope that you will bear with me. There's a tradition deep in American constitutional law. Professor Rose mentioned it yesterday. It's a tradition that I shall refer to as the Republican tradition, with both a small and a capital R. A tradition that was the driving force behind Abraham Lincoln's Republican Party in the 1860s, and before it, the Free Soil Party. Behind Thomas Jefferson's Democratic Republicans at the turn of the 19th century, and before that, behind the writings of a group of Commonwealth writers, most prominently James Harrington, in England in the 17th and 18th centuries. What is this Republican tradition? The tradition is basically one in which there's a recognition that in order for one truly to be a citizen in a democracy and to participate in its democratic process, one needs a minimum amount of independence. Economic independence is necessary if the citizen is to be able to deliberate on the common good, the res publica, the thing public, hence the word republicanism. According to this tradition, the problem of poor people is that, in a real way, they have no wills of their own. You may give them the right to vote, perhaps, but they will alienate that right. They will sell it to rich people or to foreign tyrants. They lack some minimal stake in society sufficient to connect their own personal interests with that of the larger public interest. This is one of the reasons that Thomas Jefferson was so concerned about cities and so hostile towards them. He saw cities as breeding grounds for the kind of urban proletariat that had no real stake in the common venture. I've been talking about property thus far. We can also consider military service as a substitute, an alternative way of demonstrating that one has a commitment to and stake in society. The participation of many people in the Revolutionary War led to a feeling that they should not be disenfranchised, disentitled to participate in public deliberations just because they did not meet the property requirements of the time. This led to various land reform movements, including the abolition of primogeniture and entail. Lincoln's ultimate decision to propose the 13th Amendment to emancipate blacks was in large part triggered by the fact that blacks had served as soldiers. Look, in fact, at Section 3 of the 14th Amendment. The definition of the presumptive voting body of the states is identical to that of the militia, males over 21. Or consider the 26th Amendment adopted in 1971, extending the franchise to 18-year-olds who were at the time bleeding and dying for this country. In short, there's a Republican vision that Thomas Jefferson had of a yeoman farmer standing on his own land, pitchfork in one hand, able to provide for himself and his family, with a musket in his other, capable of serving the militia and defending his country. There is in this vision a strong hostility to the notion of a standing army, a mercenary army. The standing army is dependent, it's paid by the government. The same kinds of intuitions that many people today have about bureaucracy, welfare, and dependency on government, I think, were held by the framers and illustrated by their concern about standing armies and mercenary armies. I suggest that there are two basic ways of dealing with the Republican notion that in order for a democracy to work, people must have a stake in society. The first is the underside, the dark side of the Republican vision. It's the exclusionary side. It's the Athenian solution, and I would suggest it's the original American solution. That solution is to enslave people, to ruthlessly disfranchise people who do not have property, to adopt poll taxes and property qualifications. Indeed, human slavery led to a host of economic rights provisions, property provisions in the original Constitution. We see it in the two clauses about non-importation of slaves. We see it in the Fugitive Slave Clause, the Three-Fifths Rule. It's lurking in the background of several other clauses in the Constitution. This is dramatic evidence that economic rights or property are not per se a good thing. We need to ask questions about their distribution. Who has economic rights? Who has property? And to how much? And for what purpose? Edmund Morgan, in his brilliant book called American Slavery, American Freedom, elaborated on the seeming paradox of the fact that you have radical language about liberty, equality, and the rights of man coexisting in the same society that enforces a regime of human slavery. But in an odd way, it's not a paradox at all, because it's the enslavement of many people that provides the economic well-being of the rest who constitute the polity. Ironically, slavery provides a rough equality among whites. They are all equal in being free men, and enough economic rent to allocate to poor whites to make them economically independent, to co-opt them. But this original Republican solution was radically modified by the Civil War and the 13th Amendment. There's a new solution to the problem. It's no longer the Athenian solution of enslavement. It's an inclusionary solution. It's a solution that says we will not allow a degraded class caste of people to exist in our society. It's a solution that provides inalienable property rights of people in their own persons. Moreover, I suggest, is a vision that provides for, especially under Section 2 of the 13th Amendment, 40 acres and a mule, is a vision that provides a right to sustenance and shelter, minimum sustenance, minimum shelter. I submit the standard legal discourse has de-radicalized this 13th Amendment vision, this inclusionary vision. The people who adopted the 13th Amendment provided for rights against the world. A Martian looking at our Constitution would probably see the 13th Amendment as its most radical provision. There's no state action requirement, unlike just about every other provision in the Constitution. We fought a civil war over this. It radically changed the social and economic structure of our society. The people who adopted it did not know that the 14th and the 15th Amendments were going to follow. They thought the 13th Amendment was quite broad. I suggest that when the Reconstruction Amendments are viewed as a whole, a radically different vision of society emerges. Precisely because the 15th Amendment gave former slaves the right to vote, and the 14th Amendment made them citizens by dint of their birth, you have to make sure that they'll have a certain minimum stake in society with the 13th Amendment. Otherwise, you couldn't trust them to be voters under the 14th and 15th. Thaddeus Stevens, for example, had a policy of subsidized public education, of land redistribution in the South, 40 acres and a mule, and of homesteading in the West, 160 acres in the Homesteading Act. You can see connections now between the educational vision of Brown versus Board of Education and Thaddeus Stevens in the Reconstruction. Now, one thing about some of these new economic rights provisions is that they're slightly redistributive. Abolishing primogeniture and entail changed the cluster of existing Lockean property rights. Land reform in the South was redistributive. Indeed, the 13th Amendment itself affected the most massive deprivation of slaveholder property without just compensation imaginable, notwithstanding the provisions of the Fifth Amendment. Public education is in some ways can be seen as redistributive as well. Wealthy people pay more school taxes than poor people, but poor children are no less entitled to public education. In the West, we did not auction off lands to the highest bidder. There was a distributional vision behind the homesteading provisions of giving subsidized land to folks as long as they were going to farm their own homesteads. What happens when there's no longer enough land left? That was assumed by Locke in his famous Lockean proviso. I suggest that there's a connection between the safety valve of Western land 100 years ago and language about the safety net today, about trying to create situations in which everyone has a minimum stake in society. It's interesting that soon after the closing of the West in 1890, Americans adopted the 16th Amendment, which provides not simply for an income tax, but a predictably progressive, That is a redistributive income tax. Now, Professor Epstein has made some arguments about how the original understanding of the structure of the Constitution was anti-redistributive. His argument, as I understand it, is not so much textual as structural, looking to the ideological background of the framers of the Constitution. But if you're going to do that for the original Constitution, to engage in that level of generality in constitutional interpretation, to be consistent, to be a principled interpretivist, you have to be willing to do the same thing when looking at the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments, or the 16th Amendment. And you have to recognize that they were motivated by a rather different vision of economics and democracy. Now, let me end with several quick caveats, lest I be heard as making an even broader argument than I want to. First, the notion of minimal entitlements is not a notion that everyone should have an equal amount of property. It is more a 13th Amendment vision than a 14th Amendment vision. It's not an argument that equal protection under the 14th Amendment means equal property, but rather that freedom under the 13th Amendment means a notion of some minimal entitlement. Second, this vision is not a socialist one. It celebrates the notion of private property, but suggests that we have to extend the benefits of that to all citizen society, or at least extend the benefits of some minimal property entitlement. This is the vision of Charles Reich in his classic article on the new property. It might suggest some implications for the Rodriguez case dealing with minimum right to education, or for voucher systems in employment and education, not necessarily a socialist system in which people have property rights in each other's incomes. Third, 40 acres and a mule is not a dole. It is not welfare. It is much more like workfare. 40 acres and a mule do not yield a harvest without labor. And in the process of laboring, a citizen can gain self-respect and respect of others. Fourth, I have not, at least here, argued that the 13th Amendment, this 13th Amendment vision of 40 acres and a mule is judicially enforceable under Section 1 of the 13th Amendment. There may very well be a variety of institutional limitations on courts that make them unsuitable for the task. Rather, I have stressed the obligation under not only a moral obligation, but a legal, a constitutional obligation of Congress under Section 2 of the 13th Amendment to implement it. Congress has both a constitutional right and a constitutional duty to implement this vision. Finally, I am not rejecting wholesale, but simply modifying three basic procedural notions of prospectivity, generality, and non-discrimination, said by some to underlie our constitutional scheme of property protection. Prospectivity has to be complemented by a vision of substantive baseline. Prospectivity, or non-retroactivity, says that whatever existing property rights you have, they have to be respected prospectively. But we need a theory about initial baseline entitlements, starting points. We need a theory about the birthrights of inheritance of every American citizen. That's what the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments are all about, birthrights of every American citizen. The proposition about generality must be supplemented by a vision of independence of citizens. The way to create that independence is to give every citizen a minimum stake in society. This is good both for the individual and collective self-governance, much as freedom of speech can be derived from both an individual theory of personhood, autonomy, and self-expression, and also from a theory of democratic self-rule. Finally, the notion of non-discrimination, which is often assimilated to the which is often assimilated by people like Professor Epstein to non-redistribution, has to be qualified by the need to accommodate modest redistribution so that we can make real today the vision of 40 acres and a mule for every American. Thank you.
The next speaker is Charles Fried, who was revealed in your program as formerly Solicitor General of the United States. He has a new job teaching law at Harvard.
Professor Marr dispensed me from the need of reading the first three pages of my talk because he clearly pointed out the connection between property and liberty. It's why we care about property, because property is the guarantor of liberty. There are two conclusions from this and two dangers which relate to those conclusions. First of all, there's the conclusion which we thrill at when we look at the promise of decisions like Nolan, First English, and just a few months ago, the Allegheny-Pittsburgh coal case. This is the conclusion that property is not secure if the property of an individual may be arbitrarily singled out for confiscatory treatment. Now, that's a very valid conclusion, and it's terribly important. But and I think it's the heart of the Just Compensation Clause. What I want to do today is explain to you why I fear that we shouldn't overdo our crowing about those decisions or that particular danger. Because the real danger to property and the real danger to liberty does not come from the thrust of random confiscatory action such as were condemned in Nolan, but rather the real danger to property and the liberties that are implicated come from egalitarian redistributive schemes. Now, I urge the caution on you because thrilling too much and getting too preoccupied with takings clause, just compensation cases will betray us into a preoccupation with what, after all, is in today's world by far the less serious threat to our economic liberties. And second, as Richard Epstein has unwittingly taught us in his book Takings, the threats cognizable under the rubric of takings are relatively marginal, and so correspondingly is the power of the remedies we may plausibly invoke against them. While the threats to property under the heading of egalitarian redistribution are serious and potentially devastating. Now, this is the decade in which the whole world has discovered the virtues of the market. In the communist bloc, with the exception of Albania, Czechoslovakia, North Korea, and Romania, the market is now coming to be understood as the ultraviolet lamp which will cause enterprise to flourish. And it is appreciated there by many for the right reasons, not just instrumentally, but because of its intrinsic relation to the conditions of human liberty. Bureaucratic control, statism in general, are seen as the enemies of liberty, and liberty is seen as the sunlight in which prosperity will flourish. It is rapidly becoming a commonplace that these developments are of epoch-making significance. Slogans such as the relentless march of history towards socialism, the obsolescence of capitalism, are now being torn down in the town squares of the mind all over the world, just as are the statues of Lenin and Stalin and Mao. There's another more local, yet more radical, complete, and for our purposes, more relevant example. I think of Margaret Thatcher's Britain. Aspects of socialism and bureaucratic community control over enterprise, property, and the details of everyday life, which once in that country were thought not only irreversible, but inevitable, the common destiny of all advanced economies, and in this respect, we were thought to be backward and barbaric, have been dismantled with a ruthlessness which few in this country would have thought possible. And as Mrs. Thatcher is fond of saying, she will go on and on. And so I suspect she will, so long as her opposition persists in treating the past as if it were the wave of the future. In this, our own milder and less thoroughgoing revolution is similar. I think the party of liberty will also go on and on, while our opponents remarkably refuse to draw the lessons of their failures and rejections. In this country, the Reagan revolution may have accomplished less in the way of deregulation than might have been hoped. Our congressional system puts us too much in the thrall of special interests which resist the withdrawal of privileges and protection. But we have gone farther than any other nation, including Thatcher's Britain, in one crucial way. We have drastically lowered tax rates, and that was done in the first months of the Reagan years. For it should be clear that no amount of deregulation, and of course no amount of refraining from outright arbitrary Fifth Amendment violating takings, is much good if the fruits of our enterprise are taxed away on frankly egalitarian and confiscatory premises. I should add one more fruitful and important area where litigation has been and will continue to be successful in combating state confiscatory trends and asserting the values of economic liberty: the response to quotas, set-asides, and governmentally compelled racial preferences. It is hard to imagine a more intrusive and insidious attack on the value of economic liberty than that which authorizes the imposition on employers and contractors who have been guilty of no discrimination and have not the slightest disposition to discriminate, because those who do discriminate, hang them up by the ears and do whatever you want to them. To impose upon those who haven't discriminated a regime of preferences and quotas which are justified by little else than the bureaucrat's sense of what an appropriate racial or gender makeup of a workforce should be. These then are the reasons why liberals, in the classic sense, liberals like us, have given property rights so prominent a place in our catechism. We are concerned above all with freedom and the flourishing of the human spirit. Now I want to explain why the path of constitutional litigation, what one might call the ACLU model, is unlikely to produce much relief and is an inappropriate direction for our energies. The text and inspiration for the litigation effort has been Richard Epstein's book, Takings. Brilliant as it is, I find it an uncertain guide for the project of liberal, in the Hayekian sense, reconstruction to which many of us are devoted. First, there is the issue of constitutional method. Epstein would seem to be an extreme example of what Henry Monahan has called the "our perfect constitution" school of interpretation. Recognizing, as he must, that the just compensation, due process, and contracts clause are by themselves textually insufficient to accomplish the task, he invokes the fact that the framers and ratifiers of these texts were imbued by the spirit of Locke. Locke himself, however, it is noticed, was himself insufficiently Lockean, nowhere more tellingly than in the famous Lockean proviso. Thus, Epstein is moved to complete not only the text of the Constitution by reference to the Lockean spirit, but Locke's text itself. Needless to say, this is a constitutional method which can and has been put to less salubrious ends. There is a second, more damaging flaw in Epstein's constitutional project. His is a paradigm of the argument that proves too much. Epstein quite rightly notes the toothlessness of the court's threshold for regulatory takings, a complete destruction of all investment-based expectations. And we've seen that, for instance, in the recent Supreme Court decisions on rent control. He would go on to include many other things, including the progressive income tax. Well, that's all very exhilarating, but as a program for litigation, it's a non-starter. And worse, it is a positive invitation to distraction of energy from political endeavors, which, though requiring greater patience and effort, have, as I've pointed out, shown themselves capable of producing substantial results. There is another reason why I have not been as enthusiastic as some about following the ACLU constitutional litigation strategy for establishing economic liberty. The crucial case here is First English Evangelical Lutheran Church of Glendale. The most modest reading of that decision is to see it as the condemnation of ad hoc smiting, of a practice which had become a favorite of California regulators and jurists, and that is, take the property, leave the property owner twisting in the wind for about 4 or 5 years while he litigates, and then if the regulators lose, just give it back to him. Now that's all right, and that's not, you know, that's a practice worth smiting. But if what you have here is the celebration of a wider notion, The notion that interim takings generally create a due process, create a taking right, I am worried. The straw in the wind is that Justice Brennan was one of the champions of this proposition in the San Diego case. Let me read to you what Justice Brennan's vision is and see whether we share it. Until the end of the 19th century, freedom and dignity in our country found meaningful protection in the institution of real property. But these days, when common law property relationships dominated our litigation, are past. To a growing extent, economic existence now depends on less certain relationships. Licenses, employment, contracts, subsidies, unemployment benefits, tax exemption, welfare, and the like. Protection of human dignity requires a much more modified view of the proper relationship of individual and the state. The point is that if property owners can charge rent to state regulators for the period they are deprived of their property during successful court and administrative challenges, so might the holders of the new property. Thus, would the system of egalitarian entitlements in the welfare bureaucratic state be more deeply entrenched and any conceptual gaps in that system be filled and completed by constitutional doctrine. This would portend, in my view, a significant increase in the cost of entitlement and welfare programs with a corresponding redistributive shift. And if you think my concerns are fanciful, consider the case of Schweiker against Chalicki, in which this very argument that I was interpolating was made by Lawrence Tribe, who was counsel for respondent in Schweiker and Chalicki, where he said that persons who had been stricken from the disability rolls only to be returned with full retroactive payments could bring Bivens action against the Secretary of HHS and the Administrator of Social Security. And Tribe says, of course they can bring that. And why? From the inception, I'm reading from his brief, I'm reading from his brief. The government's award of retroactive benefits hardly reflects compensation for the wrong done by violating the beneficiary's Fifth Amendment due process rights. Retroactive benefits without interest represent a sum demonstrably less than that which the government or its agents would be obligated to pay to those beneficiaries simply by virtue of the takings clause as construed by First English. In other words, what you're going to do if you push that button too often and if you succeed is you're going to give very little relief for the kind of interest that property really needs. And what you will be doing is you will be digging in deeper, completing, making more thoroughgoing the system of egalitarian redistributive entitlements. It seems to me that in this respect, if you sow the wind, you shall reap the whirlwind. My sense is that our energies are far better placed in digging in, extending, and perhaps renewing the kind of revolution which we saw in the first months of the Reagan years and which Maggie Thatcher was able to accomplish in Great Britain than it is by following what I call the ACLU model of turning the judges loose on this problem, because I think in that direction lies very little relief. Thank you.
The next speaker is Jeremy Rabkin of the Department of Government of Cornell.
Thank you. Francis Bacon says somewhere, it's better to excite brief attention than to instruct a tedious length. And I will try to follow that advice, particularly so because the first one of these Federalist Society symposia that I spoke at was at Harvard, and Professor Fried was there, sitting in the audience, a friend of mine sitting next to him. Professor Fried turned to him and said, who is that guy droning on and on and on? My friend said, that's Jeremy Rapkin. So I'll try to be brief, but I also will be a bit, afraid, perhaps a bit oblique to this subject on the theory advanced by Professor Miller yesterday on Freudian or the cognitive theory that we don't know a thing until we know what it is not, until we have in some way put it outside ourselves. I want to talk about what property is not. And I think the Constitution and a correct understanding of the Constitution hangs very much on that. I mean, an understanding of what the Constitution is about depends very crucially on an understanding of what cannot or should not be property. To appreciate this point, I think you might go back just a bit before the Constitution to one of the great legal texts that the framers of the Constitution were constantly turning to. I mean, Blackstone's commentaries. Blackstone defines defines property as a despotic dominion over the external things of the world to the exclusion of everyone else in the universe. I want to call your attention to the word despotic. Now, Blackstone also, in another place, says that the authority of Parliament is despotic. I really like that word, despotic, in the 18th century. Today, we don't even like to call despots despotic, right? So, Brezhnev was always called a leader. We won't call him a despot until Gorbachev does. But I do want to dwell on Blackstone's use of the term. I think he liked that term because he wanted to convey the point that when you have despotic power, you are not answerable to anyone else. Right? Your control is complete and it's entirely independent. The owner of property does not have to seek someone else's permission. He doesn't have to seek someone else's approval or endorsement for what he does with the property. He can stamp his foot and lord it over his property. It's entirely his. And I think that is also what he meant about Parliament, that there's no higher authority than Parliament. Consequently, in the British system, Parliament doesn't have to seek approval or endorsement from anyone else. But of course, Blackstone himself realizes that's somewhat troublesome. You don't want political authority to be despotic. And he quickly makes the point that, well, fortunately for us, this despotic authority is internally checked and balanced by the structure of our Parliament. The Commons and the Lords and the King keep each other in check. So this, what is in a legal sense a despotic authority, is in practice not that. Now, of course, we haven't in this country been satisfied even with that degree of internal check on legislative authority. But just dwell for another minute or so on why Blackstone makes that parallelism. I think it is not too surprising that he uses this term despotic both in relation to ownership and in relation to rule, because after all, it had that, there is a common word in law Latin, I mean in Roman law and in English medieval legal writings, dominium. Right? Dominium means both ownership and rulership. Right? You're the lord of property and you're the lord of persons. And there is that ambiguity or equivocation in the term because, of course, in the Middle Ages there was, at least at the beginning, that sort of equivocation in real life. Feudal lords owned land, and they, in a sense, with the land, got the people on the land. They ruled over the people on their land. If you were a vassal, you got land from your higher lord, and you owed in return to him not rent, but political allegiance, as we would say in modern terms. Right? They're constantly entangling in the feudal system ownership and rule. Now, this didn't last too long in medieval England because, I think mostly on economic grounds, people didn't like that. It turned out that even the higher lords didn't want the burdens of being military chiefs. They preferred instead to be, what does public choice theory call them, rent seekers. Just pay me the money and we'll leave it at that. That's how that system broke down. But it still did retain certain aspects of inheriting office or inheriting rulership along with property. The House of Lords, for example, people inherit their place in the House of Lords. And of course, the most notable example of that is the monarchy. Monarchic rule is inherited. The monarchy is, in a certain sense, the king's property. This is a long digression to come back to the main point I want to make, which is the American Constitution says no to that. The American Revolution was, in some sense, a revolution against monarchy, against the last vestiges of feudalism. And Jefferson talks about this. We've got to wipe out of our land law the last little vestiges of feudalism, and the public rhetoric of the revolution is very much aimed at restoring a sense of republican authority. Republican authority means rule is in public hands. It is not something which can be inherited and traded like property. So our Constitution is not only republican in the literal sense that we don't have a monarch, but the framers go to the trouble of specifying right in the Constitution that Congress nor the state legislatures cannot issue patents of nobility. What's the objection to patents of nobility? Well, it implies a station which is in between government office and mere private ownership. Presumably a patent of nobility, it didn't have to be, but it's the threat there, the potential is that it will be inherited. So you have a caste of citizens who are neither in public office nor are they left to be despots over their private property like everybody else, but they're in this disturbingly ambiguous intermediary position. And I want to say that in general, the framers were opposed to that. And their idea of republican government is if you have political authority, you must be a public officer. And a public officer is one who is accountable to the public. His office cannot in any sense be understood as property. Now, on the other side, the framers, I think, still did like the Blackstonian conception of property. Madison, in one of his political essays, quotes Blackstone's definition of property. I think they still like the idea that in your private station as an owner, you can be, if you still like that term, a despotic. It's really yours. You're not dependent on anybody else. But you can talk that way in a republican regime because you are talking about mere ownership. It has no political implications. It is not anyone else's business. You can't have a system of ownership in that sense unless you can conceive a category of action in the world of exclusive control, which by definition, by acceptance, is understood to be something that is entirely private, so the owner can make his own decisions without having to get approval or permission from others. And I don't think I have to belabor the point that property in many spheres today does not have that kind of despotic character. It doesn't have that kind of independent character. It doesn't have that kind of well-defined character. Property owners indeed do have to seek permission, endorsement, in a sense curry favor with rent boards, zoning boards, wage boards, environmental agencies, safety agencies, and so on. That is to say, they are not entirely despots anymore. They have to worry about what other people will say. And I think that is, I mean, we call that politicizing property because it is saying it, and a lot of the defenders of this say straight out, and I'm not meaning to cast aspersions on particular law professors today, I mean, people have been saying throughout the 20th century, private property is troublesome because it is too private. It allows the owners to be too selfish. We need to impose public controls, and we've done this in a lot of regulatory modes, which involve not a clear law, but a greater degree of dependence on some public authority. But I don't think I need to belabor that point. I want to call your attention to the opposite point, which seems to me really worth belaboring a bit, because we don't usually think of this when we think of property and the Constitution. And that is the extent to which we have been degrading public office or public authority by allowing it to be exercised by private persons, by entangling it in a certain sense with the despotic character of private ownership. We have now people who exercise the, to use an archaic formula, the office of public offices. They actually are doing the acts which are supposed to be reserved for public officers, but they're not officers. Right? The most obvious example, of course, is the independent counsel. The Supreme Court said in the Morrison case, he's not an officer in the sense in which that term is used in the Constitution. I might just remind you parenthetically that the Constitution has a lot of provisions about officers. It talks frequently about officers because I think the framers are very concerned to establish the status of officers. But he's not an officer. He is merely somebody who exercises claims under the law on behalf of the public. And he does it only on a one-time basis. That's why he's not an officer. He's just a one-time despot. And there is, I mean, what I think is, Judge Silberman and Justice Scalia make this point, I think it's right. I mean, what seems despotic about that is that he is not really a public officer. He's not really, in any sense, accountable to the public. He is just empowered to go into court and stamp his foot and make a demand as if he were an owner. He owns a claim which is supposed to be the public's, and he can exercise it without public accountability. But whatever you want to make of that case, maybe you can, with Justice Rehnquist, shrug your shoulders and say, well, that's just an exception. It isn't just an exception. There really are lots and lots of examples of that now, and I think we are going to be seeing more and more examples of that. We have these agriculture marketing boards. Your status as a property owner, as a farmer, you don't actually have to be farming very much. You know, if you own a farm that could be producing lemons or various other commodities, you are entitled to vote in a special election, which is not a public election, it is not open to the public, the results of it are not accountable to the public, but the results of this election will be binding on all the other producers of your commodity and will set the price and certain limitations about how much of it can be marketed. Right? We are allowing these people to exercise a public office, what? By virtue of their private status as private owners. I mean, it is a little, just a little version of feudalism worked into our contemporary constitutional scheme. You see this now in places which seem very far removed from feudalism, and in some sense they certainly are, but I would say they are as far removed from republican government as feudal arrangements were. For example, we allow citizen suits against polluters. Now, and we allow citizen suits, what seems to me even worse, against regulatory agencies. And in cases like this, the defenders say, well, not to worry, they're not really owners. Their rights are not really rights of ownership, which they can exercise despotically. If they try to push the agency or the polluter through an injunction in a way which is excessive or harmful to the public, the judge will guard the public interest, not to worry. And it seems to me we allow ourselves to be reassured by that because we've gotten so used to the idea that judges are not going to give people their rights. Judges are not going to allow people to stamp their foot and be despots, that judges will be constantly balancing and weighing and considering public implications. And we ought to be a little bit, uneasy about that, because what we've said there is that since private property no longer has the status that it used to have or that it's supposed to have, it's okay to share it more broadly. Private property has now become rendered so to speak, safe that it can be given to people who aren't exercising private roles. But I just emphasize to you that in other situations we allow people to do the duty of public officers. We allow people to do the duty of public officers where it seems entirely a matter of private ownership claims being extended. Here's my dramatic example to end with. You can, under the Clean Water Act, bring a suit for damages for punitive damages against a polluter, and you could then bargain with the polluter and say, don't pay these damages to the Treasury, pay these damages to my favorite environmental organization, which is operating in another state. So you are exercising on behalf of the public, in fact, a kind of property claim over which you exercise not just a certain kind of foot stamping and despotic control that shouldn't be allowed to a public officer, but you even have the right to use and dispose of this claim as if someone could sell his office and use the proceeds for something else. So I want to say that if we think about property in the Constitution, we should think as much about what property cannot be in a Republican Constitution as about what it must be. And we might have an easier time insisting on what it must be if we had as clearly in mind as I think the framers did what it cannot be in a Republican Constitution.
Next speaker is Professor Frederick Schauer of the University of Michigan Law School.
Thank you. I think there is a tendency at events like this to look at the array of speakers and want immediately to decide which of the speakers is what, who are the liberals, who are the conservatives, who are the whatevers, since unlike basketball teams, we do not wear uniforms with L's and C's on them. Let me provide you. And since, in addition, some of us like to pick our opinions a la carte rather than from the set menu, let me provide you with two facts about myself to further compound your confusion and to introduce what I am going to say. Fact number one, 3 years ago, I served as a member of the Attorney General's Commission on Pornography. Fact number two, for 4 years, I have taught at this institution, most recently to 120 students in the fall, a highly sympathetic course on the critical legal studies movement. You can decide what that makes me. I will let you puzzle about that while I talk about property. Now, I mention this latter fact about myself because it is clear that people who know approximately three words and no more than three words about the critical legal studies movement know three words that say law is politics. That is a rather common claim. What is that claim? How might it relate to what we are talking about here? Why would a plausibly intelligent person seeing the dominance of legal institutions all around us, seeing the pervasiveness of law, law schools, law professors, law students, the West Publishing Company, and all sorts of embodiments of legal institutions, make a claim that law is politics? In part, when that claim is made, it is a claim about what I want to refer to as the denial of choice. It is a claim about the use of legal materials, the use of legal arguments, the use of a legal style of discourse or decision making to externalize what is in fact a choice made by the person making the argument on the basis of factors other than the ones that are then used to rationalize or justify it. When we think in constitutional terms, or when we talk in constitutional terms, this phenomenon of externalizing or denial of choice is in fact quite common. For example, with some frequency, we claim that a particular result that we desire is in fact dictated or at the very least strongly suggested by history. Note, for example, the extraordinarily strong historical component of the recent Republican revival in constitutional theory that a number of people have talked about. Note also the frequent reliance in constitutional decision making on the original intent of the framers. A reliance, I might note, that is as pervasive a part of the discourse of Floyd Abrams when he is talking about the First Amendment as it is of the Chief Justice of the United States when he is talking about the original intent of the 14th. It is a form of argument that we use to support the result that we are arguing for. Similarly, we frequently make arguments based on the text We claim that the text commands, mandates the results that we are arguing for. We are saying commonly, in effect, don't blame me, blame the text. I'm just following orders. It is not that this is the result I desire, it is the result that the text or original intent or the history of this country or something of that sort commands. The claim of denial of choice in this context is a claim that within the culture of constitutional argumentation at the level of Supreme Court decision making and at the level of constitutional theory as practiced or committed by those of us who practice or commit that art, it turns out that there are professionally respectable arguments that can be made on both sides of almost any interesting question once we are dealing with the 155 cases a year that are decided by the Supreme Court of the United States, or somewhat less if we limit it to constitutional cases, or professionally respectable arguments that can be made on both sides of a question of constitutional theory. Now, that is a phenomenon that is likely, therefore, to lead to the question of what is it that breaks the ties? What is it that allows us to choose between or among a multiplicity of professionally respectable constitutional arguments? At that point, the determination of what will serve that function is itself not an intent-based, history-based, rule-based, text-based, in any other form, a rule-based determination. That is just a different way of putting a claim that has pervaded both legal theory and larger philosophy for some time. It is a claim that the great jurist Hans Kelsen would have put in terms of the Grundnorm. It is a claim that H.L.A. Hart would put in terms of the ultimate rule of recognition. It is a claim that the philosopher Wittgenstein would put in terms of the fact that rules do not determine their own application. The claim in any of these versions is that at some point rules run out, an original intent and history and precedent and text are all in some form rules. At some point, rules run out, and the status of those rules, whether we will accept those rules, is itself not a rule-based determination. That is, ultimately, the question of whether we will treat a piece of language written in prescriptive form or treat a bit of history as constraining in a rule-based sense is not itself a rule-based determination. We can see this with some frequency in constitutional determinations, because we can see with some frequency that the kinds of things that we commonly think about as rules or rule-based constraints on constitutional decision-making, at least in the Supreme Court of the United States, do not appear to serve in that manner. For example, think about the use of precedent or stare decisis in the line of cases dealing with the 10th Amendment. Precedent, it seems to me, had little, the precedent of United States versus Darby had little effect on the decision of the majority in National League of Cities and Ussery. The precedent of the majority in National League of Cities and Ussery had little effect on the decision of the majority in Garcia versus San Antonio. And the now existing precedent of the majority opinion in Garcia versus San Antonio is, as announced in the dissent in Garcia versus San Antonio, not a decision that is going to have strong precedential weight for the dissenters in Garcia and San Antonio when at some time in the future they are in the majority. Similarly, we've all seen the phenomenon of arguments from history, whether it be of the Republican revival variety or in its stronger sense, history as authoritative rather than merely history as instructive. even in its history as authoritative sense, the arguments from original intent, made on both sides of almost any interesting and contested constitutional question. We see it on both sides of arguments from the constitutional text. With some frequency, arguments from the constitutional text seem to be persuasive. With some frequency, note, for example, the 11th Amendment or the Contracts Clause, arguments from the text are not taken seriously. In a recent Contracts Clause case, Mr. Justice Stevens said, of course we do not read the Contracts Clause literally, just as we know the court does not read the 11th Amendment literally, just as other justices at other times have suggested that the First and many other amendments ought to be read literally. How might we apply all of this to thinking about the question of property? Think, for example, about the following arguments. We could say that arguments for increased protection of property are a function of the fact that a large number of specific constitutional provisions, such as the Third Amendment, several different parts of the Fifth, the 14th, and various other provisions of the Constitution, are merely the instantiations of a broader principle. The broader principle is property. We ought to apply the broader principle that these particulars are instantiations of directly to the problems that now confront us. That is a perfectly respectable argument. Some of you may recognize it as the argument in Griswold versus Connecticut, translated into the question of property. It is the exact same argument. It is certainly a professionally respectable argument, taking the textual instantiations as merely being the temporary approximations of a larger theme, which larger theme, having been identified, we should then apply directly. At times, however, just the opposite kind of argument prevails. We say we ought to apply particular provisions, but only particular provisions. There is nothing wrong with applying the Takings Clause stringently. There is nothing wrong with applying the Third Amendment stringently. There was even a Third Amendment case in the Second Circuit a few years ago. But it is not permissible to take the Constitution as if it were preceded by the letters EG. And then proceed to look for some larger theme that we apply directly, and so on. Now, I could go through this at some length. The point, of course, is that what breaks the tie, what makes the determination in terms of those admittedly limited array of cases in which one can make a highly professionally respectable argument on both sides is a determinate constitutional argument on both sides is itself not a constitutional determination in the same way that the status of a piece of prescriptive language is not itself a rule-based determination. That is, ultimately, it appears to me that what we think about the status of property and the Constitution is a function of what we think about property. That is abundantly clear from both what Professor Fried and Professor Amar said. They have both made perfectly professionally respectable arguments, but ultimately what they were talking about was what they think and how they think about property. Admirably, neither of them externalized. Neither of them claimed that their quite divergent views about the nature of property were mandated by the text, the original intent, history, or anything of that sort. Rather, they said, these are two different economic political conceptions of property. We ought to talk about which of them is superior or inferior in political and economic terms, rather than claiming that the decision between the two is dictated by constitutional argumentation. Now, there is a second sense also in which we might also say law is politics. That claim, for those who would make it, also would say, as Professor Fried also said, ultimately, to think about law, even constitutional law, is to think about a larger universe of decision-making of which law may be only a minor component or a minor subset. It is peculiar to law that its practitioners, especially its academic practitioners, are expected to have a normative commitment to the enterprise that they are investigating. That is not definitional of the academic enterprise. We do not expect our biologists to have a normative commitment to the amoeba. We do not expect our geologists to have normative commitments to rocks. And similarly, in terms of the purity of academic discourse, there is no reason to believe that an academic investigating law rather than rocks or amoeba need think that law is important, valuable, crucial, or the most desirable vehicle towards getting to the political end that we most desire. That is a claim that has been made by Mark Tushnet from the left. It is by no means very different from the claim that Professor Fried was making. It is a caution about thinking, because we are inside the enterprise, that the enterprise that we are inside of is or should be more important than it in fact is. All of this, I suppose, is what I would say if I were a member of the critical legal studies movement, or at least a fair amount of that is what I might say if I were a member of the critical legal studies movement. Whether in fact I am, I will now lead you to think about with perhaps slightly more evidence. Thank you.
Panelists who would like to attack other panelists. Comment on, I think, is the standard word. Yeah, I just have a couple of thoughts, I think mainly in response to Professor Fried and Professor Rabkin, about new property, property created by government statutes. For Professor Fried, I actually think that you can't so quickly dismiss the new property conception as maybe a modern day invention of folks like Brennan and Tribe, because it, of course, does not begin with Goldberg versus Kelly, but in a quite strict and technical sense with Marbury versus Madison. And not the Marbury that you read in law school, which is all about judicial review, which anyone who does the history knows is not really the most problematic issue in Marbury at all, but rather with the following feature of Marbury. William Marbury has a commission. It is created by a statute. It is a government benefit. And it is assimilated, this new property created by statute is assimilated by the Marbury court to the status of property. Old property is protected as a vested legal right to, and this I think connects to Professor Rabkin, to government office. Now it may not be alienable. It may not possess all the features of property that Professor Epstein talked about yesterday, but it's interesting that even if one looks at the language of the Constitution, one sees words like tenure, tenure of office, life tenure. Well, that's a property concept. Or even if we talk about jurisdiction, one is seized of jurisdiction. Well, that etymologically or philologically, that connects up with notions of season and notions of property. Now again, I don't want to suggest that it has the full features of pure private property, but from the very beginning, I think there is a recognition that government benefits created simply by statute can and sometimes should be given the status of full property in order to vindicate the purposes of property. So that's not just Charlie Reich or Brennan or Tribe or Goldberg, that's Marbury. And one final point for those administrative lawyers out there, the statute in Marbury did not expressly create a cause of action for William Marbury.
And John Marshall didn't win the case either.
Excuse me?
And he didn't win the case either.
Not on ground, Professor Rabkin. Well, the court held that he had a legal right to a commission, that he could have gone to any court competently seized of jurisdiction, such as a state court. I'll abstract away the some Tarbell's case issues. That was decided 70 years later. The court holds that even when a statute doesn't expressly create a cause of action, courts will infer
causes of action to fully vindicate, to fully create full remedies for violations of rights. And that suggests, you know, that our current court, cutting back on Goldberg or on court against Ash or the implied rights of action analysis, is in some tension with the fountainhead of modern administrative law, Marbury versus Madison.
Yes, I'm glad you raised that question about Marbury. Because I've thought about that myself. How is it that we have a right to office for judges or for quasi-judicial officers like Commissioner Humphrey of the Federal Trade Commission? And in fact, you know, you go back and this isn't new property. It is old property. It is a very old, it is precisely, again, feudal notion of property. And it happens that in this country it's not alienable. In France, I believe, people sold their judgeships the way we sell dental practices. Right? I mean, it was once understood to be really property in a very full sense. And just point out one other thing to you. Judges are the last people in our republican regime who are called by feudal titles. Your Honor. You know, Your Honor is what they say in Russian novels when they're bowing and scraping before some aristocrat. Right? No, really. I mean, think about it. We don't call even the president with that title. I think you're right to focus on that. That's something curious. And I think the reason why we have been comfortable, I mean, I'm not so comfortable with it anymore, but the reason why we have been comfortable with this idea that judges, in a certain qualified sense, yes, have a property in their office that can't be removed is precisely because we want to say that they are not Republican officers. They don't serve the public. They shouldn't be accountable to the public. So we give them the kind of protection or the kind of status which is, in a sense, pre-Republican, where you have this bulwark of your office which you sort of own so you can't be accountable to the public. My point is just that fine, if you want to say that judges follow the law, they are bound by the law, there can be a good excuse for that. Once you admit that judges are just out there making policy and they're making judgments, that looks a lot more problematic. But certainly once you extend it beyond judges and start allowing all sorts of people to have what are in effect property rights to do a public office, I think that is extremely troublesome and problematic. And I think the same general point applies to lots of the things that are new property. And I'm thinking now not so much of welfare claims, which at least it's money, but things where people insist that they have the right to exercise a certain kind of public function without being accountable in the way that public officers are. That is very, very disturbing. And I think there's no question, even when you look at some of the things that Professor Tribe has in mind, where he wants to make everything into state action, or he wants to say that you have private rights to do lots of things that seem to be really public offices. You are losing public accountability.
Just very briefly, Akhil, you misunderstood me. I didn't say that I dismiss the new property. I'm scared to death of it. That's my point.
Do you have some questions from the floor? Unless there are other...
Professor Green, if I understood you early on in your remarks, you referred to yourself as a classical liberal, then went on to say that it was our aim to take a person who discriminates and hang them up by the ears. Now, my question is, how do you reconcile it? You suggest that people who discriminate do not have property rights.
No, they have property rights, but discrimination is I'm talking about real discrimination, not the phony kind of discrimination which the social engineers and bureaucrats have invented in order to restructure the world according to their vision. I'm talking about people who think that other people are less worthy because of their race or their gender, and therefore proceed to disadvantage and really defame them on that basis. I'm talking about real discrimination. And it seems to me we have, we fought a civil war about that. I'm quite comfortable with coming down very hard on that, in part because by coming down very hard on that, we avoid mushing over into what is what would turn this country into contemporary Czechoslovakia, where you get a job on the basis of whether your father was a member of the proletariat or not. So I think it would be dangerous to allow your classical liberalism not to condemn true discrimination, because by condemning true discrimination, you are in a position to draw the line and really stand up against what is one of the great threats to our liberties.
I have a question there. Welcome, Your Honor.
I am Professor Charles Norman he's taken the blinders from our eyes and shown us that the role against weight is not mandated by the text of the country. But the benefit of that insight, though, I wonder why we accept as your descriptively accurate understanding of the political nature of some constitutional decision making. Without that standing as a lamentation for the loss of the security and liberty of citizens. That is to say, are you supplementing that some sort of more disciplined, more bounded approach to constitutional interpretation is impractical, institutionally impossible, doomed to failure, as perhaps.
I guess what I'm saying, and have said a number of times in the past, part of how I think about these issues these days, unlike many people, I do not think that a very strongly rule-bound or formal, to use the common pejorative that I want to unpejoritize, a formal interpretation of law or a formal interpretation of the Constitution, I take to be a linguistic and a conceptual possibility. In that sense, I think Fuller, among others, was wrong. I can imagine a conception of law that would say that even the statue of the vehicle should be excluded from the park. It is a conceptual possibility at that level. I think as well, it is perhaps not quite that clearly a conceptual possibility at the constitutional level. We could have a much more text-bound text-bound constitutional culture than the one we have, even with the text that we now have. I have so suggested at times. I remain of the view that that is a conceptual possibility. I guess what I am saying now is that the choice between the text-bound interpretation of the text that we now have or an original intent constrained determination of the text that we now have are as conceptually possible as the much more political indeterminate conception of the Constitution that we now have. All of those conceptions compete with each other. Rules do not decide among those conceptions. And as you've probably noticed, I'm now not giving you an answer in terms of which I'd choose among those, although I think I have by saying that I certainly want to claim that a very different vision is very possible conceptually. One of the reasons I don't want to choose among them goes back to my remarks about rocks and amoeba. My other knock on the American academic legal culture is that it assumes that it must necessarily be normative. It assumes that the role of the constitutional scholar is to whisper in the ears of the Supreme Court. In almost every other discipline, it is entirely appropriate for a scholar to be explanatory, descriptive, analytic rather than making short to intermediate term prescriptions about how current political actors ought to make their decisions. I don't claim that there's anything wrong with that style of constitutional scholarship. I am troubled by the fact that in the world in which we now live, that is considered to be the only appropriate style of constitutional scholarship. My statement in objection to it is my refusal to give a normative statement about which among the three we should choose.
Roger.
It is.
I think so.
My question is for Charles Fried. You've drawn together a number of themes in a very interesting way, Charles, as usual, but I'm not so sure that I'm convinced by the conclusion you're urging upon us. Let me put my question this way. I think you're quite right to focus upon the massive redistributive schemes as ultimately more threatening to our liberties and our property rights than the first evangelical kinds of cases. But I think Epstein is focusing upon the takings as the paradigm, as it were, that mutatis mutandis applies right straight across the board, including to these massive schemes. I am not so concerned in light of that with the kinds of applications of First English to the new property that Larry Tribe is urging, because I mean, if it has to be applied there, then so be it, even with the Bivens actions. We've got to live with that or else change the law. I am concerned, however, with your, if I understand you correctly, urging us to take the focus off the ACLU type approach and move it more toward the political realm, which works briefly as it did in the 80, 81, 82 period, but that too passes, as you know. I am concerned in particular with that thesis for reasons raised by the public choice school. That is to say, we live with the Iron Triangle, we live with the concentrated benefits and the dispersed costs, and with the incentive structure that you and I both know makes it very difficult to get anything done in Washington and to get any changes. And I'm wondering how realistic it is to focus our energies exclusively in this area, when in fact the ACLU model seems to have advanced that agenda for them, and indeed, if we look at First English and Nolan, for us, and may indeed continue to do so. I think, in other words, that we need both emphases in our overall agenda. I wonder if you would respond to especially the public choice aspect and restraints upon the political agenda.
Well, sure. I think there is only a certain amount of energy. I may be wrong about that. Energy in one area may provoke energy in other areas as well. Fine. But I look at this audience, and at least those who are wearing the uniform in it, and I think what a talented and energetic group of people. Wouldn't it be marvelous if once again the Senate and the House, and that one's happened, were in, should I say our, in Republican hands? That could be. And wouldn't it be marvelous if more state legislatures were? Then I think you'd begin to see something. It's just that I don't think the Nolans of this world are really particularly significant one way or the other. That you can, after all, you could destroy Mr. and Mrs. Nolan by some new statute which does something to the coast and some new regulation, and you'll never be able to lay a glove on it in litigation. And the only way you can make a true dent is in the way that Ronald Reagan did in the first months of his administration with a tax rate. That made a difference. Now, I don't think that's going to be, that wasn't a passing episode. It's going to be very hard to change that. No doubt people will try. And I am really concerned about where one puts one's energy, because my observation is that the payoffs for liberty and for economic liberty are in politics. And in an odd way, I think we have spent not enough time on politics.
Lee?
That works, yes. I've got a question for Charles and a question for Professor Schauer. My question for Charles is, it's nice to say that, and you're probably right, that constitutional litigation is a small part of the political scene. Nevertheless, you can't, someone brings a case and he says property means a certain thing. Say he says property means 40 acres and a mule. Somebody else brings a case and he says property means something different. And you know, it's not an answer. It's not a persuasive answer, let alone, you know, a good answer to say we shouldn't get into that. I'm scared to death of these questions. You have to decide them on the merits one way or another. And you know, the Justice Holmes, for example, in Lochner said, I'm scared to death of courts getting into these problems, and you know, it's a really terrible thing. But in fact, you have to decide either that property means 40 acres and a mule, or you can't get away, in other words, from the baseline problem simply because it's scary and because courts have to decide, because courts may have to decide in favor of the plaintiff sometimes. For Professor Schauer, my question is there a difference between hard cases and impossible cases? That is to say, it's true that you can frequently make arguments on both sides of a question. That doesn't necessarily mean that the answer is indeterminate. It just may mean that you have to think long and hard about it. And that leads to rather different conclusions, and is a different line of argument from the other point that you were making, that you have to have a theory of legitimacy or a theory of something in order to be able to justify an answer. And you know, your justification for your theory of legitimacy may ultimately be somewhere other than, may ultimately be extra legal. So which of the two arguments are you making?
Well, I think that Holmes got it right in Lochner. That means that in the end, a large number of these areas have to be left with what the political branches have done. And what I'm urging is that we capture the political branches more effectively than we have. We've only got one of them. Let's get, maybe two. Let's get the third. Is what I'm saying. Now, let me give you an analogy, Lee, which from another area, religion. I think we are in a dreadful mess about the religion clauses in our Constitution. It's like an overstuffed trunk, you know, and you think you got it closed and there's a sock hanging out the back. And so you've got that sock in there, and then there's an undershirt in the front after all. It doesn't work. Now, the reason it doesn't work is because the court has done what you've said. They've tried to give an answer to everything. In fact, the right thing for the court to have done would have been to back off, way off, on both free exercise and establishment, and to say, you know, it's not a violation of the free exercise clause unless it really is some kind of an imposition of religion. It's not a violation of the establishment clause unless it's an official religion. And everything in between is politics. How much better off we would have been? Not to mention how many silly decisions in the Supreme Court we would have been spared. So I think that... And that extends to other areas. So that's how I would
react. But that ultimately has to be justified in terms of what free exercise means and what the Establishment Clause means. Yeah. You can't say, oh no, this is going to be because courts will get into things. It has to be because of a theory of what the language means. If it's a legitimate decision as opposed to an imposition of the will of the court.
Fine, I'm giving you a theory of that if you like.
I agree with your distinction. Part of what I am saying, and I'll say it now a little bit more directly, drawing in part on what I think, but far, far more on the kinds of things that Akhil Amar's colleague George Priest has said and Llewellyn said earlier, we select cases by their difficulty. Cases go from one level to the next as a function of their difficulty. I think there are easy cases. I think the easy cases are successively selected out as we get higher and higher. When we get to the last 155, I think they are impossible, even though I accept your hard, impossible distinction. But when I say impossible, I don't mean to be a nihilist, whatever that means. I don't mean to say it's up for grabs. I mean to say it is impossible to resolve them by consultation of the legal, with a capital L, positivistically identified materials. They are legally impossible. That doesn't make them politically impossible. In that sense, as I was saying, it seems to me that we could have a system in which the array of cases were rather different. Ultimately, my major complaint about much of the critical legal studies perspective on all of this is that they are engaging in as much denial of choice as they accuse others of. That is part of what I'm trying to say and what I was saying in response to Judge Ginsburg's question a few minutes ago. I take a non-formal system to be a choice among others. The standard critical legal studies line is that non-formalism is inevitable. It is not inevitable. We could have a system in which formalism or more formal structures were possible and would work. Then we have to decide which we want. To say that what we've got, our non-formal system, is the only one we can have is itself a denial of choice that I'm trying to object to. But I agree with your distinction. I'm just making an empirical claim about the array of cases.
Go ahead. Go ahead. I think you've been on the floor there longer than he's been before the microphone.
Well, that's very fair.
I took that.
Pardon me. I want to ask a question about something that really hasn't been discussed today, and perhaps in part because it's a problem that I don't think any of us here in this room would ever face, but I think it's a property question that should be discussed. A number of laws, a federal law, and I think a number of state laws now, say, and I'm quoting, there shall be no property right in, and they then list the fruits or instrumentalities of drug dealing. I'm curious to know, I guess I'll pose the question to Mr. Fried and perhaps also to Professor Amar, how you feel particularly about the instrumentalities clause. We're involved here in something where the state is regulating behavior, not taking only the fruits of what is considered illicit behavior, but indeed many courts have determined that a single drug transaction in a home which has been earned, which has been paid for by legitimate earnings, forfeits the home, the car, any intermingled cash, and so forth. I'm interested in your perspective on it specifically, if you can. If not, I understand, from the Eighth Amendment excessive fines clause, which original intent indicates does not apply only to criminal fines, to the takings clause, and to the forfeiture of estate clause, which I recognize would only apply in spirit, not technically. All of this, of course, assumes there is no drug exception to the Constitution.
Well, since I would think that capital punishment would be perfectly permissible and appropriate.
Excuse me, I'm speaking in terms of the civil forfeiture statute.
No. Since I think it would be perfectly permissible and maybe appropriate to execute rather more of these drug people than we do. Dead. I have a lot of trouble finding that there's a constitutional inhibition in taking away their homes. Now you're saying, well, it's a civil rather than a criminal.
I assume that's an important distinction in the law, right?
You think it that if it's a Well, the theory, of course, and it's a very old one, is that the instrumentality of crime is forfeited to the state, becomes a contraband, a deodand, whatever. It's very ancient, and a long lineage is one of the elements of property. So I think you just, if you use your home for drug dealing, you pay your money, as it were, and take your choice. Why is that problematic?
Well, I believe it's problematic for a number of reasons. One is, I mean, if you're asking me, I don't need to get into it, actually.
No, I am asking.
Oh, okay. One is that criminal protections are not afforded, and it clearly is an excessive fine. In the King's, I think it was the Kingsley case last year, the Court of Appeals stated that everything was taken from this man except the clothes on his back, and indeed the clothes on his back could have been taken. This was done without any criminal protections. A number of courts have ruled that due process don't require prior hearings, and indeed some of the forfeitures are done administratively with no judicial intervention.
I think you're wrong about that. No prior hearings, but there has to be a hearing eventually.
Okay. Are you asking me? I'm sorry, I got spaced out in my own thinking here. Are you asking me why I believe it's constitutionally improper?
Yeah.
Okay. I would say if it was criminal forfeiture, it's not constitutionally improper.
Mm-hmm.
But that there's a burden shifting to the claimant. Sixth Amendment rights are limited. And indeed, I think the punishment is often beyond the scope of the crime. You and I simply have different views on that, I suppose.
Yeah, well, I mean, you may be right. You may be right. You make a case. The fact that this is done civilly, you may have a point. Hadn't thought it through.
Professor Amar, let me explain. I ask you only because, I'm happy to hear all your thoughts, but I pointed towards you because of the notion that the statutes have been used to strip all property from individuals.
Yeah. I really haven't thought enough about the specific technical questions to give you a satisfactory answer. But just to connect up the drug issue to larger themes, issues of drugs implicate notions of dependence and independence. And I think maybe we should ask not just what are suitable punishments, but why so many people are on drugs. And part of it might have to do with not having ground to stand on. But frankly, to tell you the truth, I think this also implicates the limits of property as the constitutive basis of both individual and collective self-governance. Property can do a lot of things, but we need, it seems to me also, sort of a spiritual foundation, both individually and collectively, to sort of fully think about what it is to be self-governing, both in the individual and collective level. So I know that that's not at all a satisfactory answer to your technical question. I would just have to think about it a lot more.
Okay. CLS people and possibly Professor Schauer spend a lot of time focusing on how lines that traditionally have thought to be clear in the law, like public, private, law, politics, are in fact not a priori clear and are social and historical and political constructs and so on, which have various consequences. And one line that came up implicitly in several of the panelists was the public-private line. That when you're deciding whether if you're a classical liberal, how you feel about anti-discrimination laws, you have to decide how public a public accommodation is. And whether, you know, maybe a bed and breakfast isn't, but a Hilton is. Or when you go back to Plessy v. Ferguson, you know, once you're a common carrier, are you completely in the public arena, or are you still partly, or is there still some private property there? That it's not clear, and it shifted throughout our history. That before 1964, it was thought that the right of someone who owned a small shop to restrict his clientele on the basis of race was sort of a property right. But then that went away, and it shifted from and the activity shifted from being more private to being more public. And similarly, in these private attorneys general cases that Professor Rabkin was talking about, clearly there's been some implicit shifting in what counts as public and what counts as private, showing that while the line may not be completely indeterminate, as the CLS people would tell us, it has varied through history, and and at the margin probably is not theoretically determined, that you have to make some decisions that don't have an absolute a priori justification. And I'd be interested in anyone's comments on how, in constitutional interpretation, one determines lines like that. If one just decides how the line was drawn arbitrarily in 1787 and then applies that positivistically, or whether, for example, the enforcement clauses of the post-Civil War amendments mean that Congress has the authority to move those lines around a little, or whether courts have authority to move those lines around a little, because it's clear that those lines have moved historically. I think it's also clear there's no, at least theory that I'm aware of, that purports to explain exactly how this gets done and by whom.
Do we have a taker?
Let me offer a 30-second clarification, or not clarification. Certainly, I think you draw an important distinction. There are some people who would say, wrongly, that the difficulty of drawing a line suggests the impossibility of drawing the line. We deal with fuzzy lines all the time. We can all distinguish night from day, bald from not bald, or frogs from tadpoles, despite the fact that there is no precise point at which the tadpole turns into a frog. I think you're right in saying that the line between the public and private has some fuzzy edges, insofar as people would take the fuzzy edgedness of that line to be an indication of the non-conceptual viability of the line. Let me emphatically disengage myself or distance myself from anyone who would make that claim. I think what you do say is that even if we can draw the line tolerably well, it may be that there are choices involved in having chosen to draw the line here rather than in other places. If there are choices involved in having drawn the line between the governmental and the non-governmental, for example, rather than between the big and the small, can those choices be changed? Where did they come from? And so on. That, it seems to me, is an important question that I'll let the other three people answer.
In the approximately 1 minute that remains, does someone have an answer?
I'll just say one thing. This won't answer most of what you're asking, but it seems to me in administrative law, it's very important to keep your focus on coercion of third parties and to keep your eyes fixed on what we would allow somebody to do in private law. Because although that's almost out of control, it's not entirely out of control. You cannot launch a tort suit against somebody out there doing something wrong. I mean, it's got to have done a direct injury to you. And you should at least try and hold on to the distinction between going after the second party who's done an injury to you and just going out there to punish wrong or to correct wrongdoing. That seems to me the sort of elemental distinction between public and private in this, and you ought to limit the authority to punish wrongdoing apart from people who've done you injury. You really ought to limit that to public officers.
There are more questioners, but it is 11 o'clock. I think we should give ourselves a break. Thank you all.